everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here on Wacker, and we're here until 5 a.m. It is Monday. That means we're going to say hello to my dad. He's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're also going to talk about comfort food recipes that are nutritionist approved. We have some stories about some animals that we're going to be doing, and napping are some of the topics that we're going to jump into. As you heard, right now, though, it's Monday morning, and that means we're going to do the Monday morning movie reviews. Jim Laskowski and Eric Childress join me every Monday to review the new movies. I've only got a couple of movies to talk about. Eric Childress, by the way, is at the Sundance Film Festival right now, and he's going to check in with us in just a few minutes to jump in here and give us some exclusive reviews of movies that he is seeing while he is out there at the Sundance Festival. So, well, right now we're going to start off with Jim Laskowski. We're going to review some of the couple of the new movies, and then we're going to talk a little bit about some of the most underrated movies of the 80s. That's all coming up. Plus, a live appearance from Eric at the Sundance Film Festival. So let's get Jim on the show. Hey, Jim.
Hey, man. How's it going?
All right. So we're gonna review a movie here, Jim, and then Eric's gonna jump in about 10 minutes or so, or something like that.
Okay.
To give us reviews of the stuff in Sundance. So why don't you start us off here? Colin's got a new podcast, correct? On the Now Playing Network.
Oh yeah. There's a lot going on lately, and I think it's been great to have Colin on in podcast form. It's mainly going to be, with his busy schedule, it's mainly going to be like a monthly show. But you know, the name of his podcast is Christmas Movies Actually, and it's hosted by him alongside his girlfriend Carrie Finnegan. And you know, every month they sort of cover a Christmas themed title. You know, even though the holiday season is over, there's still plenty of you know, Christmas films, both classics and weird and, you know, unusual, that, you know, he can uncover. And, you know, he's kind of an expert in that. It's one of his subgenres that he really, really is passionate about. And the most recent episode he did was the Laurel and Hardy movie Babes in Toyland, which was a really interesting discussion in light of the recent biopic Stan and Ollie that just came out. It's a wonderful show. I mean, he's doing a great job with it, great editing, great chemistry, of course, and it's just a blast to listen to. So Christmas Movies Actually is the name of the show, and it's over at nowplayingnetwork.net.
Okay, and then the Movie Madness, the latest episode of Movie Madness, is also available?
Yeah, and that's, of course, Eric's great show. They just had a really interesting recent episode. He tends to have Sergio Mims on quite often as a guest, and you know, they really dive deep into some interesting titles, and the most recent episode they had was on movies that should be released on Blu-ray but haven't yet. You know, some out of print titles or movies that just have been only available on DVD for a while, and they really go in depth on a lot of must-see films that they want to see, you know, in the best format possible. So that's a great episode, and that's the most recent episode of Movie Madness, which is really, really well worth your time.
All right, cool. All right, and you can all check this all out at nowplayingnetwork.com. So very cool.
Yeah.
All right, Jim, tell us about The Kid Who Would Be King.
Sure. So this turns out to be the latest film from a director I've been anticipating a follow-up film from, and that would be Joe Cornish, who previously gave us this really delightful science fiction action horror film called Attack the Block. I think it was back in 2011. So it's been a while, but this time he sets his sights on the legend of King Arthur and the infamous Sword in the Stone legend that has been portrayed on the big screen many times. The most recent version of it was courtesy of Guy Ritchie with his mega flop, King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is pretty much a disaster, which, you know, coming from Guy Ritchie, that's no big surprise. But here, with this story, we begin with a really impressive sort of hand-drawn animated prologue, and it showcases the origins of the King Arthur tale. And we learn about the valiant King Arthur and his Knights of the Round Table. And they once successfully vanquished Arthur's wicked half-sister, Morgana, who here is played by Rebecca Ferguson. And so she attempted at one point to take over the world, but then that was unsuccessful, so she recoiled into the soil, vowing to one day return for her vengeance when hearts are hollow and the world is divided and leaderless. We jump forward to modern-day London, and we glimpse this a lot of newspaper headlines that display things like doom and gloom and a country divided. And as a news anchor is sort of relaying the rising dread across the land, we meet our young protagonist, Alex Elliott, played by a very charming newcomer, Lewis Ashbourne Serkis, who is also the son of motion capture legend Andy Serkis. Alex is a 12-year-old struggling with, you know, being at a private school where both he and his best friends are continually bullied by two other students, and they're sort of just, you know, going through the motions and growing pains of being in adolescence. But after his two teenagers chase Alex into this abandoned construction site, he stumbles upon an ancient medieval sword, which is firmly embedded inside this concrete slab. And of course, he naturally attempts to retrieve it out of curiosity, and to his surprise, the sword slides right out and becomes rightfully his to keep. And so from that point on, he encounters some very strange, peculiar things. And he's initially skeptical that this could be the legendary Excalibur from the tale of King Arthur that his estranged father once read to him when he was younger. But he stashes the sword, and then the evil Morgana begins to awaken. And her return, as well as the discovery of Excalibur, sort of signal this ancient sorcerer and magician, Merlin, who is initially played by young newcomer Angus Imbri, and as well as sporadically played by Patrick Stewart. So Merlin takes the form of a teenager and decides to, let Alex in on all the things that are occurring. Of course, a lot of it's bad news. In 4 days' time, a solar eclipse will bathe the Earth in darkness, allowing Morgana to sort of rise up and seize control of the world. And she's, of course, aided by this army of flaming zombie skeleton demons. And she also has the ability to transform into a giant monstrous dragon. So now that the sword has seemingly chosen Alex as the new owner, he must find the strength and courage to become a daring leader and create an army capable of defeating Morgana in order to save the world. Most people are familiar with the King Arthur legend. Like I said, it's been adapted many times, some successful, some not. And I was just mainly very curious about a new film from Joe Cornish. And I was, much like you, I was really, really charmed by the trailer and the sight of seeing Patrick Stewart essentially returning to the role of Merlin. I was really looking forward to the film. And I'm a little surprised that the studio sort of just chose to release this movie as long as it's in the morning. Well, kids, you know, are back in school, and most would prefer to stay home. And I think that's kind of a shame, because this movie, you know, it's delightful. It really is. I mean, it's predictable to some degree, but I'm a fan of films where kids sort of band together, you know, to overcome some evil force out there, or simply just go on an adventure that doesn't involve adults or parents. You know, I like these throwbacks to kind of the Amblin era of like outdoor kids adventure stories, essentially. And I mean, it helps to sort of stick with that legendary story that most people know and love, but setting it this time in modern times. And I think the cast here really carries the film quite successfully. All the young students here and friends that band together, I think they make a good team. I was a little disappointed by how little we get to see Patrick Stewart, but I do think the younger teenage version of Merlin was a lot of fun, and he brings a lot of energy to the character. I think the Lewis Circus does a really good job of playing curious and sometimes hesitant without coming across as obnoxious or frustrating. You know, I mean, it's a little long. You know, it's pretty close to 2 hours, and I think it. You know, the pacing could have been tightened up just a little bit, and also I would have enjoyed seeing Rebecca Ferguson a little bit more here and there. I think she has too little screen time, but you know, for me, I think to sort of beat the winter doldrums and with the lack of interesting releases in January in general, this is actually really satisfying entertainment. It doesn't elevate itself to greatness, or it's not anything we haven't seen before, but it didn't keep me from having a good time. I really like this movie. I think both parents and children will get a kick out of it, and it's nice seeing the King Arthur parable in modern-day England. So I'm saying going out and give this a look. I'm giving it a recommendation here.
Yeah, me too. I thought it was really really entertaining and a lot of fun. And I really thought all the kids were really great in it. And there's they have a great chemistry between them, and there's a nice energy throughout the entire movie. And Joe Cornish, he's a really solid filmmaker. You know, I love Attack the Block. I thought that was a really terrific movie. And I agree with this is a little bit long, but it didn't bother me enough to not recommend it. I like what they did with the cliches that are inherent in the story, and all the things that we've known about this story that's been told like a million times. But they brought a freshness to it. The director brought a freshness to it. And like I said, the kids are a lot of fun. The special effects are really good. I think Rebecca Ferguson makes a great villain. She's really scary and lots of fun. There are a lot of big laughs in the movie. Like I said, the special effects are quite good. I was not aware that Lewis Ashbourne Circus was Andy Serkis's son until after I saw the movie. And he's really good in it, and you know, holds the lead really well. Like I said, all the kids are really great, and it has that sort of same feel as Attack the Block. You know, people coming together in order to fight, in order to fight evil and overcoming obstacles and all that cool stuff. So it seems to be a theme that's in Joe Cornish's wheelhouse that he has, he really likes to explore. You know, the theater was not packed when I went to go see it. Now, granted, we had terrible weather over the weekend. We're going to still have terrible weather this coming week. But I agree with you, Jim, that the dumping this movie at the end of January seems to be a dumb decision, because I think there could be quite an audience for this movie, and if people aren't going to go see it into the theater, I think it's going to be a pretty big success when it hits home video or VOD. So I really liked it. Yeah, I think it's very entertaining.
I definitely hope it becomes like a little bit of a cult classic.
Yeah.
You know, I think it deserves it, and you know, Joe Cornish, I want him to work more.
Yeah, so. I agree. Yeah. So yeah. We both like this one. That's a recommendation right there. The Kid Who Would Be King, we're gonna recommend that. Jim, hang on, okay?
Okay, will do.
Right, okay, there you go. Jim Liskowski's gonna hang on. We're gonna hear from Eric Childress in just a couple of minutes as well. We'll do that right after we take this break here on 720 WGN.
Of light in the skies over Hollywood.
All right, welcome back, everyone. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m. It is Monday morning, and my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we reviewed one of the movies this week. Jim Liskowski, Eric Childress will join me every Monday morning for the movie reviews. Eric, though, he is actually at the Sundance Film Festival, and he is joining us to do a little preview of some of the movies that he's seen. Jim, welcome back.
Hi there.
All right, we're going to chat with Eric live from the Sundance Film Festival. Eric, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, how are you?
I'm doing okay.
All right. So, what's how long you been there now? You were been there since Thursday?
Thursday, yes.
All right. How many films have you seen?
I have seen 17 movies.
Jeez. Oh man, unbelievable.
Yeah.
Okay.
So one on Thursday and 16 over the weekend.
16 movies over the weekend.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you know how this works. We just you just pick the ones you want to tell us about. These are all like sort of we're getting exclusive reviews here from Eric, who's live in Sundance. How long are you going to be there?
I'm going to be here into Wednesday. Got a couple movies going to see on Wednesday, and then we get back Wednesday night.
All right. Yeah. All right. It's good. I don't know if you know what the weather's going to be like on Wednesday night.
I've heard.
Oh my.
Yeah, I've heard.
Yeah. Should be fun. All right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, start wherever you want to start, Eric.
Well, might as well start with the first movie I saw Thursday night, and I know it's one that you're very eager to talk about,
yeah.
And that's a movie called Memory, The Origins of Alien. And this is a new film from Alexandre O. Felipe, who did The People vs. George Lucas and 7852, the documentary about the Hitchcock shower scene.
Ah, yes.
Okay. And this film, I mean, the title, you know, kind of says it all. Memory, the Origins of Alien. Memory was one of the original titles of Dan O'Bannon's idea for this, you know, was become, you know, celebrating its 40th anniversary this year, this incredible science fiction horror masterpiece. And the film takes us through, again, this kind of starts off taking us through a bit of through Dan O'Bannon's career, his life, how Dark Star came to be about, and how he was then at one point hired to work on Jodorowsky's Dune project, and then eventually, you know, how Alien came to be, including through his various directors, and then kind of takes us through kind of a talking head panelist kind of thing, critics, pundits, scholars kind of thing. You know, going into, you know, a lot of information about, you know, what the film is, you know, really about, and, you know, taking us through various shots of the film and how, you know, just certain placements of the actors are meant to represent something much larger than what, you know, we might be thinking or even seeing. It's just a scene of dialogue, and yet the placement of characters, things like that, actually, you know, bring greater meaning to the film. So it was, again, it was my only movie Thursday night, and it was a 10 o'clock movie, and it was a day of traveling and getting the condo and groceries and all that kind of stuff. So by the end of the night, I was both tired but absolutely pumped to see this movie. And part of it, you know, like the stuff about Dan O'Bannon, I think is really nicely done. It's kind of a nice tribute to him. Though part of it is kind of like, Felipe was almost kind of trying to do his own Jodorowsky's Dune movie by showing you all of the movies that Alien kind of ripped off over the years. A lot of side-by-side comparisons, and you know, some that I was not aware of, and some are, you know, are very obvious. And I was just like, well, that's, you know, a weird way to start a tribute to this masterpiece by saying, well, that was basically just cribbed from all these other movies. Then you got like the talking heads, not exactly an A-list crowd, shall I say, and I got to say that a lot of their commentary kind of rubbed me the wrong way, only because they weren't presenting a lot of new information to, you know, any of us from our respective generations who grew up with this movie. We know, you know, that the implications of rape and pregnancy and working class politics and things that come into this movie, and yet they all kind of talk about it like it's the first time we're ever heard such, you know, revelations about the film. Ben Mankiewicz actually has a particular whopper about Walter Hill, Nick, that maybe you can help clear up a little bit. At one point, he kind of throws a little shade at Walter Hill.
What?
Because Walter Hill was going to direct Alien.
Yes, right.
At one point.
Right.
And then he left the project, eventually went to Ridley. And he says, and Walter Hill, you know, left Alien, and he went on to do Southern Comfort.
Mm.
And that's wrong, right?
Yeah, Alien came out in 79.
So the Warriors.
The Warriors was before Alien.
It came out
like January of 79.
Okay.
So I mean, my guess is that he would probably, if he left Alien, he left it to shoot the Warriors. That would be the timeline.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, and Southern Comfort's 2 years later. Southern Comfort's 1981. So I don't know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So when I heard that, I'm just like, okay, if you're going to leave that out there, is even the representation that like Southern Comfort, you know, there are parallels to Alien, you know, character, working class characters getting picked off one by one by mysterious forces, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That's one thing, but they don't even really comment on that. So I kind of left with kind of mixed feelings about it. There's some really interesting things about it. The talking head panelists, again, some of them just like, dude, we know this already. But then like them breaking down the chest burster scene from different angles. And the camera shots that were used and whatnot was, from what I understand, is what this project was originally supposed to be about. It's supposed to be a little bit more like 78-52, but all about the chest burster scene. And instead, that's only kind of like the last 20 minutes of the movie, basically. So it's not a complete, I'm not completely down on it, but I got kind of mixed feelings about it. But people are going to want to check it out regardless.
Yeah. Okay, that's Memory, the Origins of Alien. Does that have a release or anything?
Not yet,
okay.
Surprisingly. I'm sure that's going to be, someone will pick that up.
Yeah, I mean, it's a documentary about one of the greatest science fiction movies ever made, so I think it's going to be
right.
It's going to be picked
exactly.
up. All right, so that's Memory, the Origins of Alien. All right, where do you want to go next?
Yeah. Well, let's go to the movie that made the biggest splash, like right out of the box. I mean, usually some of these big deals that come out of Sundance, usually kind of wait through the weekend. There's a lot of wheeling and dealing going on, a bunch of negotiations, and sometimes people aren't, you know, exactly sure where the buzz is on some of these movies, if they're going to pan out. And right out of the box, Amazon picked up a movie called Late Night for $13 million over the weekend. I think it was on Saturday the deal was finalized. And this is Mindy Kaling's new film. Mindy Kaling wrote the film and co-stars as a wannabe comedy writer who ends up kind of backing into a job for a late-night talk show that's been hosted by Emma Thompson for going on several decades, or at least a couple of decades. And Emma Thompson's character, the late-night host, is kind of not living up to the modern standards of your Fallons and Kimmels and really pulling in a younger audience. So she's kind of on a decline. The network boss, played by Amy Ryan, is kind of ready to push her out. So she hires a female writer who has really no writing experience. She works at a chemical plant. That's a running joke throughout the movie. And an all-male writing staff, and she is supposed to become the fresh new voice on the panel. So this is a movie that is basically about, as kind of an old school talk show host, hopefully getting a burst of fresh energy from a new generation, possibly a new woke generation. And yet this is a film that has the exact same problem throughout as the talk show itself. Once it kind of makes the shift to freshen up the show through Mindy Kaling's writing, it doesn't really do much of anything. It might do something in the fictional world of the show, but watching it as an audience, you're going like, where is the bite? Where is, there's no controversy here. This movie plays it completely safe right from beginning to end. And I have to say that the Mindy Kaling character, who is almost an equal, Emma Thompson is more the star of the movie, that a lot of people have been kind of comparing it to like Devil Wears Prada, as far as their relationship is going. I think that's a little too harsh. I don't think Emma Thompson's character is nearly as evil as Meryl Streep's was in that movie. But it's a movie that plays it completely safe, and I think Mindy Kaling's character is a big problem with this film. I would have rather seen her cut out of this film entirely and seen the movie focus more on Emma Thompson's character and the deals of ageism and sexism. And, her husband in the movie is played by John Lithgow. I'd rather have more scenes of the two of them together then you know, this rivalry that's going on in the writer's room. And, you know, we've said this many times on the show before, Nick, that movies about, like, stand-up comedy are usually not very good.
Mm.
They're just, you know, they seem to never save their best jokes for the movie. Seems like they're holding it out for their own stand-up routines or something, because the stand-up material is just never that great in a lot of these movies, with a few exceptions. And this one is no exception. So it's crowd-pleasing because it's safe. But as, you know, a movie worth $13 million, this one really isn't it.
Okay. All right. Well, that's kind of a disappointment. Hang on, okay,
yeah.
Guys? Hold on a second.
Okay.
All right. Jim and Eric are here, and Eric is live at the Sundance Film Festival, and we're getting exclusive previews of some of the movies he's seen. That last one was called Late Night, got picked up by Amazon, and there you go. All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, more reviews straight from the Sundance Film Festival there at Childress. And Jim Laskowski and I are going to talk about, a little bit later on, we're going to talk about the underrated movies of the 80s. We got the box office to talk about, and one new movie to review as well. All right, when we come back, more from Sundance right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is Monday morning, and that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're also going to talk about comfort food recipes that are nutritionist approved. We've got some animal stories to get to, and much more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Jim Laskowski and Eric Childress join me every week to talk about the movies. Jim is hanging out. Hey, Jim.
Hello there.
And Eric is live at the Sundance Film Festival and just was reviewing a couple of movies. Saw 17 movies since Thursday. So plenty to choose from. All right, Eric, let's get back to it. What else do you want to talk about from the Sundance Festival?
Okay, well, let's get to some of the good stuff now. And I saw a movie yesterday morning that really kind of blew me away. And it's by far the best thing I've seen at the festival so far, though it hasn't been picked up. I'm sure it certainly will at some point. And it's a movie called The Report. And this is based on the true story of a staffer to Dianne Feinstein, who in the movie is played by Annette Bening, who was tasked with writing the a full-length report on the CIA's torture methods post 9/11. The staffer's name was Dan Jones, and the movie is played by Adam Driver. And the movie was written and directed by Scott Burns, who's frequent collaborator of Steven Soderbergh. And this movie is as crackling a political thriller as I've seen in some time. This is up to the levels of, it's not a journalism movie per se, it is an investigative piece, and it feels like those great movies about journalism that we've seen, movies like Spotlight and All the President's Men and The Insider and things like that. And it's one of those movies that holds you in its grip for 2 hours. Adam Driver, in other movies would feel like a lot of exposition and sometimes even, a little bit of, prosthetizing and stuff. And it never feels stale. It never feels like exposition. It always feels like you are, part of the outrage. And it really gives you a greater sense of, you know, people who aren't quite sure where they stand on the torture debates, the idea that, you know, people would do anything necessary to keep the U.S. safe. Well, this movie gives you a greater sense of just how nefarious these tactics were. and how political they became. I mean, the cover up of it afterwards that is only kind of touched upon in Vice a bit. This is another movie that kind of throws Vice way under the bus as far as all those the Bush Cheney years are concerned. It's an amazing cast when you go through it. The actor they get to play a New York Times reporter in the movie who meets with Adam Driver in the back half of the movie is some of the most inspirational casting I've seen in some time. You're gonna get the joke as soon as he shows up on screen.
Mm.
This movie is just absolutely fantastic. I could have sat there and watched it for another 4 hours. It held me so tightly. So The Report is my favorite movie at Sundance so far.
Okay, that's The Report. Does it have a release date?
Not yet. Doesn't have a distributor yet.
No, it doesn't even have a distributor yet. Oh, wow.
No.
Wow, with a cast like that?
Are you looking at it?
Yeah. It's crazy.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Wow. All right, so that's The Report. Boy, Adam Driver's having some good stuff happening to him right now.
Oh, my God. You know, seriously, I mean, if a distributor gets a hold of this and plays it for Oscars, I could see Benning possibly getting a supporting actress nomination, and Driver will certainly be talked about for Best Actor.
Okay. All right, so that's The Report. That sounds good. All right.
Yeah.
Where do you want to go next?
Okay, I got a couple movies from directors that I know. All I got to say is from the director of And You'll Be In. Doesn't even matter what it's about.
All right.
The first one is a movie called The Nightingale. And it was directed by Jennifer Kent, who directed The Babadook.
Ah, yes.
Okay. But this is not a horror movie in that sense. It is a revenge tale. An Irish woman has a really horrendous experience with a number of soldiers, somewhere in the Australian outback, and she proceeds to hunt them down. This movie, has it's kind of like a bit of it kind of starts like a spit on your grave in a way, but it transitions into Jennifer Kent's kind of mashup of The Searchers and True Grit, more in that style. And yes, it does have The Searchers shot in the movie.
Oh, it does.
I mean, it's a little long. It's 2 hours and 16 minutes long. The young woman, she hires an Aboriginal tracker to hunt down the soldiers. It will, your bloodlust will certainly get up for this movie. But it's going for something greater, too, like I said. I mean, comparing it to Searchers and True Grit, I wouldn't quite put it on those pedestals, but that's clearly what Jennifer Kent is going for in this movie. And I'm looking forward to seeing it again because, the first time you see it and see what's happening to this woman, you just want to see the revenge part of it, frankly. But I think upon a second viewing, you probably get a greater sense of the kind of the implications of the revenge, the idea of revenge that she's, trying to talk about throughout the film. So it's good. It's a good film. You're going to enjoy it.
Okay. All right, so that's The Nightingale. Any word on a distributor for that one?
That's IFC, and I believe there's been some people have thought it was coming out soon. I think it's not coming out until the summer.
Okay.
So we'll see that from IFC during the summer sometime.
Okay, so that's The Nightingale, and it's Jennifer Kent's new movie, and she was the director of the great movie, The Babadook.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. All right. All right, Eric, where do you want to go next?
Okay, well, here's another one from the directors of Good Night, Mommy.
Mm.
Yeah.
All right, you know what? Eric, hang on. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and talk a little bit about the next movie here. Jim, you all right? Jim? Okay. let's find out if Jim's okay. We'll take a quick break here. We've got more coming up here. Eric Childress is live in the at the Sundance Film Festival, and he's got more movies to review. And then Jim will be back, and we're also going to talk about underrated 80s movies right after we take a break here on 720 WGN.
Walk along.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. All right. We got Jim Laskowski and Eric Childress here. They review movies with me every Monday morning. Eric is at the Sundance Film Festival right now, and we're getting live reports from him. And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you much.
And Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, so right before the break, you said from the directors of Goodnight Mommy, which made made me perk up big time. So what do we got here?
Well, okay, before I describe this movie to you, I have to tell you two things really quick. One, you have to you will notice that the Goodnight Mommy filmmakers have a type.
Mm-hmm.
For certain.
Okay.
And second of all, you will probably have to start suspending your disbelief immediately because this movie could also be called World's Dumbest Dad.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So, a family, okay, two young children, their parents are finalizing their divorce. Dad is planning to get remarried. He's a writer, and he's written a number of books apparently on cults. And he is now planning to marry his current girlfriend, who is was formerly the 12-year-old survivor of a cult that completely committed suicide.
Oh, man.
Okay. So, so after, as they're planning to get married, for the holidays, for Christmas, they decide to go to, their lodge up in the wilderness. And Dad's going to go off and do his work and leave kids with the new mom, former cult member, in the house all by themselves.
Mm.
How can this go wrong, right? Okay, the mom is played by Riley Keough, who continues to impress more and more. Every time I see her, she really just stays on my radar. And this movie is absolutely no exception. To really get into this movie would be to spoil a bunch. And while I was watching the movie, as the movie begins to reveal itself and what it's actually going for, I said to myself, it would be very hypocritical of me to recommend this movie, given that I don't think M. Night Shyamalan has made a good movie in his life.
Mm-hmm.
But the difference between the Goodnight Mommy filmmakers and Shyamalan is, one, they really know how to stick an ending, and two, they really know how to work a theme up to and through that ending.
Yeah.
And this is one of those movies that, you know, because it deals with, you know, cults and whatnot, so it deals with religion. And this movie really kind of gets in the head of people, you know, of any religion who are so deeply committed to what might come afterwards affects the way that they behave in reality. So that's kind of a prevailing theme throughout this movie. And again, as the movie kind of reveals itself, I was sitting there going, don't end here. Please don't end here. And then it doesn't. And it keeps going. I'm like, oh, good. And then it keeps going. And it goes some more. And then it wow. this movie, yeah. So, I mean, you love Goodnight Mommy.
I did.
You kind of know what you're getting into with these guys. Some people have compared it to The Shining because they're isolated in this lodge during a snowstorm and stuff. You know, some people go off their meds. I'm not going to say much more.
Okay.
But all I'm going to say is that I really dug the film and very much looking forward to seeing people's reaction to the third act of this movie.
Okay. All right. That's the lodge. Right. Well, I mean, if you've seen Goodnight Mommy, and I don't know what to say about that except that I love that movie and it was brutal. And I love it. Okay, so that's the lodge. I'm looking forward to that. Does that have a distributor?
Not yet.
Wow.
Not yet. Yeah, there's a lot of hot titles here that we're hoping to get picked up very soon.
Yeah, that's true. Man, oh, man. Okay. All right, where do you want to go next, Eric?
Let's go to a movie called Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile. And basically this is Zac Efron.
Is this the Ted Bundy?
That's correct.
Oh, okay, all right.
Yeah, this is Joe Berlinger's narrative feature about Ted Bundy. He also has a four-hour docuseries that either just premiered on Netflix or is premiering later this week, which I hear is fantastic. Mm. So he actually did a docuseries on Ted Bundy and did a feature-length film with Zac Efron.
Wow, all right.
Yeah, and the movie more or less focuses on one of his final actual relationship that he had with a woman played by Lily Collins. And then the movie takes us through his arrest and eventual farce of a trial. It's not really about the murders themselves. There's not a lot of, with the exception of like one thing, we don't actually see him murdering people. It's all about the aftermath of that and how either he was in complete denial of what he had done or was just so evil that he could conceal it and just deny it all the way through, almost up until his execution back in 1989. Joe Berlinger, over the years has created some of the best true crime documentaries out there.
Yeah.
And at the same time, he's created some of the most maddening narrative features out there, like Blair Witch 2, Book of Shadows, mm-hmm. and this one.
Okay.
Because, the Ted Bundy story the title pretty much says it all, and those are words that came directly from the judge, who in the movie is played by John Malkovich. The judge, when he was sentencing Ted Bundy, those are the words he actually used to describe him. And here you have Zac Efron, who, good-looking chap.
Yeah.
Zac Efron. So you have, this kind of this almost like a Playboy image being, presented of Ted Bundy and a very charming guy. And, that's part of the story as well. But there's a lot of stuff in this movie that is played for laughs. I mean, the trial itself is nuts in and of itself, but it's as the movie... I don't know if Berlinger was just knows that we know that Ted Bundy did commit these crimes, or if he's actually trying to suppress the idea for those who don't know whether he was innocent or not. Because in the entire movie, he denies everything that he did, and all the states that he keeps getting arrested and tried for, he's denying it 100%, and then ends up representing himself in court over it. So the tone of the movie, I think, is completely off. Focusing on the relationship, I don't think entirely works until the final scene between them, because it kind of emotionally wrecked her. And I think the movie sidesteps a little bit a bit too much for my taste, and they really focus on him more than her downslide after when she really discovered who this guy really was. So I thought that wasn't played very well. Zac Efron's very good in the movie. I can't fault Efron, particularly in the back half of the movie. He's really good in the film, and so is Lily Collins. So you have some performance to kind of guide you through this story. But at the end of the movie, I'm just like, this is a really horrible guy, and he shouldn't be treated in this kind of light. So I was much, by the end of it, I was just like, I can't wait to see the Netflix docuseries, because Berlinger is much better at documentaries than he is in narratives.
Okay. All right, so that's called Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. All right. What do you want to do next?
What are we going to do next? I'm looking at my list here. Let's do a film called The Last Black Man in San Francisco.
All right.
And this one has been, A24 brought this movie to Sundance. I apologize. I don't know the name of the actors in the film. A few are recognizable, but the main stars, I don't have their names in front of me. But the movie was directed by a newcomer named Joe Talbot. And this movie is really kind of the announcement of a real major talent. Last year, at Sundance, both we had both Sorry to Bother You and Blindspotting, and both one of the central themes of those movies was gentrification. And that's primarily what this movie, I mean, it's one, I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on in this film, but it's primarily about gentrification of San Francisco. These two best friends in the film, one of them has, there's this house in San Francisco that his he's been told all his life that his grandfather built in the 1940s. And even though it's currently occupied, he continually shows up at the house, or they continually show up at the house to paint it and do repairs on the outside of it, at much to the chagrin of the owners. And when the owners, the current owners, actually get evicted from the house, they move in and begin fixing up the place. Even though they don't have any money to buy it, they don't have anything to hold it with, they basically just move in and, you know, do their best to just maintain this part of history. History plays a big role in this film. There's a lot of things that that creep up on you, not just gentrification, history, sort of the whole history of African Americans in this country. I mean, this movie is either both times it's kind of a love letter and a hate mail to San Francisco. And the movie acknowledges both of those factions. It's beautifully shot. It's energetic. It's really funny at times. Ultimately, very sad. This is a movie that, when it was over, it was like, wow, we kind of really want to see that again, and really take a second look to absorb, because there's so much going on in this film. It's so beautifully acted by everyone involved. Really one of the standout films of the festival so far.
Okay, that's The Last Black Man in San Francisco, and A24 has got that one already.
Yeah.
And I see Thora Birch is in it. Where has she been?
Well, yeah, I mean, she's had problems with her career due to her father and stuff.
Mm.
She had one of those showbiz dads that really kind of screwed her over the years, and she's only got one scene in the movie.
Oh, okay.
It's really late in the film, and it's kind of like, oh, there's Thora Birch. Okay.
Mm. Okay. All right, that's The Last Black Man in San Francisco. All right, Eric, how many more movies are you planning on seeing?
Let's see. I got another five later today, and then another five on Tuesday, and so I got like a dozen more movies to see.
Is there anything standing out that you're looking forward to?
There's two things. There's a movie called The Death of Dick Long. That's actually the next movie I'm seeing. That's directed by one of the guys, one of the Daniels who made Swiss Army Man.
Oh, okay.
And this is apparently, again, they have a type two, because this is another movie about a bunch of friends trying to conceal a friend's death.
Jeez. All right.
Yeah. And I hear that movie's kind of nuts. There's a movie called Them That Follow that's all about Pentecostal religion that I hear is incredibly intense.
Mm.
I'm looking forward to that. I am seeing the worst kept surprise screening in the history, I think, of any film festival is playing tonight as well, and it's Fighting with My Family.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to be seeing that as well. I think The Rock is supposed to be here, or Dwayne Johnson is supposed to be here for that.
Yeah.
So I'll have a report on that as well.
All right, cool. All right, Eric, thanks for hanging out with us, man.
Sure thing.
All right, buddy. Have fun out there, and Eric will join us again with another report. Jim, hang on, all right?
Okay, man.
All right. When we come back, Jim and I will talk about another new movie, and then we've got some underrated 80s films that we're going to get into as well. So that's all coming up right after we take this break here on 720 WGN.
Movie, evening, shooting.
Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we're back. Eric is off. He's in Sundance Film Festival, and we want to thank him for giving us exclusive reviews of some of the movies that are debuting there. And we're back here. Jim Laskowski is with us, and let's get Jim back on the air. Hey, Jim.
Hey, man. How's it going?
All right. Why don't you tell us about Serenity?
Oh, boy. All right. Well, this is a movie I'm excited to talk about, but also weary of talking about. I'm going to do my best to sort of
It's going to be really hard to talk about this one. I mean, just in terms of, yeah.
Yeah. What we have here is that people aren't aware, it's actually a sequel to Interstellar, because we have Matthew McConaughey and Anne Hathaway. it's funny because, like, the trailer sells this as a modern-day kind of, like, film noir. Something like, I know Eric described it last week as kind of like this late 90s erotic thriller, akin to something like Palmetto or Wild Things, or even to some degree something it was advertised like maybe like it could be another Simple Favor. And that's what you're kind of getting here at the beginning. The movie opens with this overhead shot of a fishing boat in the middle of this pristine blue ocean. And the boat belongs to a rugged, stubborn man named Baker Dill, played by Matthew McConaughey here. And while he's out with two tourists and his first mate, Duke, played by Damon Hansu, he gets a line on a massive tuna fish that he's been chasing. He wants that tuna so bad he even gave it a name, Justice. and then, you know, we sort of get to know this town that Baker resides in, and it's called Plymouth, and it's this town that sort of recalls like the swampy Florida Keys, but feels even more isolated from society. He's kind of been on the run from his past, suffering post-traumatic stress from service in kind of an unnamed war, as well as drinking all night at the local watering hole. He, you know, just sort of dwells in this environment and, you know, doesn't really, he's really immersed into his job and the boat. And of course, the tuna fish that he really needs to catch named Justice. But he also occasionally romances a neighbor named Constance, played by Diane Lane, who in return for some affection gives him a few bucks if he's ever hard up for cash. And the final piece in this noir jigsaw is a femme fatale named Karen, played by Anne Hathaway. And she's essentially the high school sweetheart from his past, who rolls into town with her abusive, rich husband, Frank, played by Jason Clarke. And, of course, she has a very provocative proposition. If Baker takes Frank out fishing, pushes him overboard, and leaves him to die, she will give him $10 million, no questions asked. So the rest of the film hinges on, well, will he do it? Is she on the level with him? Are they still in love? And there's also an interesting subplot that we keep cutting to involving Baker's teenage son, who, you know, has been isolated and kind of missing his father. And, you know, both father and son might have some other connection that is best left unsaid. And honestly, that's about all I can say about this plot. It really starts out as a typical noir thriller, like I've mentioned. And there are a lot of characters scattered throughout the town that seem to know a lot about Baker's plans and his plight. There's this mysterious character that keeps popping up with a briefcase that may also play a role in all of this. And the thing is, I don't relay my opinion on this film without going into greater detail, because it does have some twists and turns. And all I can say is that the reviews for this movie have been really harsh, and saying it's preposterous, idiotic, and some people have compared it to M. Night Shyamalan with the direction it sort of decides to go into and calling it laughably bad. For me personally, I would say that this movie is pretty laughable and aims for way too much, but I also I didn't hate the experience of watching this play out. I mean, about an hour in, some audience members in my theater sort of jumped ship. no pun intended, but I felt like they kind of just gave up. But I will say that I'm a fan of the screenwriter. I'm a fan of the cast, obviously. It's nice to see Anne Hathaway and Matthew McConaughey on screen together. But, and I think that the thing is about the material, though, is that it takes itself too seriously to some extent. I think if they would have let McConaughey sort of get a little more bat crap bonkers in this and kind of more like a hammy way to bring a little camp into the whole thing, I think it would have made it even more entertaining. But for some reason, I didn't think this was a waste of time because it goes in a direction I didn't expect at all. And I like the feeling of not knowing where a film is going to take me. Is it a complete success? Not in the slightest. It's very, very flawed. But it's also this just weird B-grade sort of existential thriller that I guess kind of jumps the shark, but not in an uninteresting way. I definitely wish it had more flair and style like a De Palma movie. Because it could be something along the lines of Femme Fatale if it wanted to be, but it's not up to that level, in my opinion. So I can't really recommend that people rush out to the theater to see this. I'm more in the middle on it, and I even would want to watch it again. But I also think that it would be interesting for people to experience this for themselves, because it is not at all based, it is not at all what you're expecting based on the trailer and the marketing at all.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a crazy movie. It's a crazy movie. It's completely nuts. It was not at all what I expected it to be. And it does take that. Right. It does take a couple of twists to the point where, I mean, I can understand why people are laughing during this movie, because it just gets completely absurd. And but yet it's played so straightly. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, really straight. And I don't think the material deserves to be played that straight. You know, Matthew McConaughey and Anne Hathaway, I love both of them. I think they're both terrific, and they're kind of fun to watch in this. But this movie goes off the rails.
but still in, like, an entertaining way.
I didn't hate the experience of watching it, but I can't recommend anybody else go and see it, because it just really does. Yeah. I mean, it goes nuts. This is a movie that goes completely nuts, and it's hard to talk about without giving anything away. And if for people who want to see it, I don't want to ruin the experience. But let's just say it is an experience. It is absolutely an experience. So, yeah, but I can't recommend it. And it's hard. And again, as you know, Jim, this is a very difficult movie to talk about, because, you know, to get into why I had a certain reaction to it would mean that I would have to give away details that I don't want to give away.
Yeah.
But it is a crazy movie. I will say that. I mean, it's not seen anything quite like it. So yeah, I can't recommend it, but it is nuts, and it's an experience that it's an experience that I won't forget for a while, because it's pretty crazy. But it only made like $4 million over the weekend. So
I'm not surprised.
Yeah,
again, they're burying it.
Yeah, they're burying it. And I mean, I know, you know, Anne Hathaway and Matthew McConaughey did the talk show circuit, at least, you know, so they did get some word out. And even when they were being interviewed on the talk shows, it was like they really skirted around what the movie's about and all of that stuff. So anyway, so that's Serenity, not recommended, and it's crazy. So
right, exactly.
Jim, hang on. When we come back, we'll jump into the underrated 80s movies real quick and do a little bit of that before we let you go.
Sounds good, man.
Okay, Jim Liskowski is with us, and there you go. All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about underrated 80s movies. Jim put a list together of those, and we will talk about that after we get back from the break on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to tell a joke. And we've been reviewing the movies. Only had a couple of movies to review. So Jim Laskowski is sticking around. And we had a nice visit from Eric Childress live from the Sundance Film Festival and giving us exclusive previews of some of the stuff that he's seen. And he'll do it again. We'll get another report from him before he gets back from there. But Jim, welcome back.
Thank you.
So you wanted to talk about underrated 80s movies. How did you put this list together?
Yeah, well, you know what's pretty wild, really quickly, is that 30 years ago is when I first started listening to you and Roy.
Wow.
On the radio. And I think the first thing, I mean, at least the first thing I have a vivid memory of hearing you do was when you ran down, I believe, maybe 64 of 1989's worst movies on Steve and Johnny's show.
Oh, my God.
Like, you just ran down, like, all the movies you hated that year. It was pretty amazing.
Wow.
And you also revealed your 10 best films of that year, and if I recall, I think it was Casualties of War was your number one for 1989.
Yep.
And I also do this, like I mentioned last week on the show, me and Eric and Colin now have this yearly tradition of going back 30 years to sort of do a retrospective, to sort of look at the year that was, sort of use Box Office Mojo as like a template to kind of go through month by month what movies came out, which ones stood out for us, and, you know, sort of bring up some under-the-radar titles. And, you know, as I was preparing, I sort of just decided I want to put together a list of movies that I think are worth mentioning to people, you know, because, you know, especially in the winter months, you kind of want to stay in more. Maybe you want to stream something. Maybe you want to check it out and go on Netflix or Amazon to watch some older films. And so also, really quickly, too, is that Keith Gordon last year spoke with me, and we wound up doing underrated 90s films, and I invited him back for this year, and we're going to do a podcast on underrated 80s films, and these are definitely going to be among the titles we discuss.
Oh,
so that's
cool.
Pretty much how I put it all together.
That's cool. All right, well, let's get into some of them. Let's see. You got here Paper House, which is a terrific movie that about five people saw.
Yeah, I vividly remember Ebert championing this film.
Yes, he did.
And sort of describing it as like Nightmare on Elm Street meets Ingmar Bergman or something like that. And I think I saw this when I was like 12 and just found it to be really vivid and imaginative. And it's directed by Bernard Rose, who would go on to do another great horror film, Candyman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's just a really interesting movie about this 11-year-old girl who has, you know, a bedridden illness. And she draws this imaginary house with an imaginary friend, but through her dream, she can sort of enter his house in this other world of her own creation. So it's like a little bit of a Del Toro film, too, to some degree. And I just think people should seek it out. It's really a really imaginative, cool little horror film.
Yeah, I like that one, too. I dig that one a lot. Next, you got The Dead Zone, which is my favorite Stephen King adaptation. And my favorite Christopher Walken performance. I think it's the best performance that he's ever given.
Yeah, I completely agree with you there. And it's one of Cronenberg's more accessible films.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if it's as underrated or underseen, but I mean, if people haven't caught up with it, it's one of the most effective and melancholy horror films of the 80s, and sort of sets a precedent for the kind of filmmaking that Cronenberg would later do with The Fly.
Yeah,
so I love them.
I mean, Dead Zone's one of my favorite movies, but I have to say, I think it's the saddest movie ever made. I really do. the stuff that Walken's character has to go through in this movie, I mean, it is so sad, but it's so good. Let's jump around a little bit. How about Fandango? This is one of my favorite movies. I've been championing this thing since I first saw it.
Yeah, a really funny quick story is that I was once working at a church as an audiovisual technician, and one of the volunteers that worked there emailed me once at 2 in the morning because he couldn't sleep. He told me he was having trouble remembering the name of a movie where Judd Nelson jumps out of an airplane without a parachute. And, of course, I wrote him back and said, hey, that's one of my favorite movies about male bonding, and it's called Fandango.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And it's a special, special film. You brought it up many times, and it's definitely one I hope people can seek out and find.
Yeah, that's a terrific movie. It really is. How about Clean and Sober? I remember when Clean and Sober came out, it was like a big deal because Michael Keaton was going to do a dramatic turn. At that time, he was, you know, this was pre-Batman and everything, and at that time, he was just considered, you know, wacky comedy guy. And And so all of a sudden Clean and Sober come out and everybody goes, oh, wait a minute. This guy can really act. And then it was also one of the big movies for Morgan Freeman when he was starting that second half of his career and was getting noticed for, you know, for Street Smart and that too.
Yeah, he definitely pops up a lot in the late 80s. And I mean, I think this is one of the best portrayals of addiction and recovery. I mean, maybe it's matched a little bit more. I mean, maybe it's, you know, something like Drugstore Cowboy that came out a year later might be just a little bit more interesting stylistically. But you also have a great supporting turn from M. Emmett Walsh, too, here.
Yeah.
So there's just a lot to really appreciate acting-wise in Clean and Sober, for
sure. Yeah, it's a good film. We mentioned Walter Hill was mentioned a little bit earlier. We got Johnny Handsome here, which is a really underseen and underrated movie.
Yeah, again, I mean, a lot of the titles here, too, just really stand out because of the character actors giving great performances. And, yes, another movie with Morgan Freeman sort of trying to aid and support this, you know, flawed criminal character played by Mickey Rourke. But, man, it's just a really solid revenge heist movie. And it's also got a lot of heart, too.
Yeah.
And the villains, oh.
Yeah, Alan Barkin. Alan Barkin is unbelievable in the movie.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's a great movie. Again, Walter Hill, he's one of the best. I'm glad that you chose At Close Range, another walk-in movie with great performances all the way around. Sean Penn and Christopher Penn, and it's a great movie.
Yeah, really intense, really intense movie. I mean, that's you can't go wrong when you're walking and Sean Penn is father and son, but you also have great supporting turns by Mary Stuart Masterson and the late Chris Penn, too. It's got some really unforgettable confrontations in this movie. So that's really underseen. I hope people find that one, too.
Yeah, it's a great movie. Prince of the City, which is Sidney Lumet, brilliant movie with Treat Williams that not a lot of people saw, but is, I think, you know, because, you know, Sidney Lumet has made a lot of movies about New York and a lot of movies about New York cops, but I got to say that this is one of the best and one of the ones that not as many people have seen, you know, like people who have seen Serpico and some of the other stuff that Lumet has done.
Yeah, this one took me a while to catch up with too. Actually, I mean, I saw it like a few years back when Brian Tallarico actually appeared on Directors Club and we discussed some Sidney Lumet films, and I finally caught up with this and I was like, man, this is like the godfather of police corruption movies.
Yeah.
You know, it really juggles a lot, but it's all interesting and it's really enveloping. I mean, Treat Williams, too. What a really underrated actor in general. It's just a really great film.
It is a terrific movie, and Treat Williams is always good, but this is the best. I mean, this is the best performance he's ever given, and it's a big showy performance, too, and it's a complicated movie, and it's a long movie, and it's worth every minute to watch.
It's got a lot of layers to it.
Yeah,
sure.
It certainly does. And then Melvin and Howard, I'm glad you chose that one. This is another one of those movies that not a lot of people have seen. You know, the late, great Jonathan Demme directed it. It's really, I think it's one of Demme's best movies, and again, shows off that humanistic attitude that permeates, you know, almost all of his films, and great performances all the way around. Mary Steenburgen won the Oscar for it, and if people haven't seen it, it's based on a true story about a working-class guy who picks up Howard Hughes, played by Jason Robards.
I think you know why I sought this movie out. I heard about it through my favorite director, of course, Paul Thomas Anderson, who mentioned it on the Heart 8 commentary.
Yeah.
And this turned out to be my favorite Jonathan Demme movie. I love the characters. I love it's got a nice blend of comedy and drama, but also really, like you mentioned, Mary Steenburgen's great. It reminds me of like something Robert Altman might have done.
Yeah.
But it's really filtered through Demme's humane touch, and I adore this movie so much.
It is a terrific movie. Now, if anybody wants to see the full list of the 80s, where can they check it out?
Oh, they can go to voicesvisions.net. It'll be on the front page for quite a while. There's a link there, and they can check it out. Or they can just go to Letterboxd as well.
It's on Letterboxd as well, but you can also check it out on Voices Visions. And so there you go. One more real quick one before we break here. I'm glad you brought up Modern Romance and Albert Brooks. I mean, I would put like all of Albert Brooks's movies on a list that are underappreciated.
Yeah, Of course.
I think with the exception of Defending Your Life. Well, I mean, and people really responded to Lost in America, too. But he's made some movies that not a lot of people have seen, and he's a genius. And you get to see Bob Einstein, the late, great Bob Einstein, as the shoe salesman in one of the funniest scenes in the entire movie.
One of the most quotable movies ever. And I just really hope Albert Brooks makes another movie someday. He's such a unique comedic talent.
He's the best.
And light years better than Woody Allen.
Yeah, I agree. All right, Jim, always a pleasure, and we'll talk to you next week, okay?
Sounds good.
All right, buddy, take care. There you go. Bye. Thanks a lot. That's Jim Lizkowski, everybody. Okay, we'll take a break here on 720 WGN, and we'll be back after this.